And a good Sunday morning to you. I'm Jerry Kenny. This is WISO Weekend, the home of WISO-produced news and features. Today's program is all about education and conservation. In our newest series, Culture Couch, producer Dan Gummel tells us all about Project Jericho's summer arts program in Springfield. And Community Voices producer Ron Soliday reports on how College Promise is providing a free college education for academically gifted children from poverty-affected families here in the Miami Valley. Up first, three stories representing the past, present, and future of conservation efforts taking place at Antioch College. First, Antioch College and Glen Helen Nature Preserve in Yellow Springs have secured a land conservation easement that will protect 973 acres of the Glen. Here to tell us about this new development, Nick Budas, Executive Director of the Glen Helen Ecology Institute. Nick, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be here.
So this is new news, but it's been in the works for some time. Tell us about this easement.
It's been in the works for 90 years. There's always been a little bit of a cloud of uncertainty hanging over Glen Helen with the worry that should anything happen to Antioch College, the Glen would be vulnerable. For the past 10 years specifically, we've worked to establish a modern conservation easement on the preserve, something that would hardwire in a level of protection where, regardless of what happened at Antioch College, the environmental learning programs and the protections for Glen Helen would be able to continue into perpetuity.
That, of course, means a lot to folks here who know about the Glen and know the value of it.
Sure. Over 100,000 people visit the Glen every year. Over 100,000 kids have spent a week in the Glen learning in the preserve as its outdoor classroom. That will be able to continue for generations to come.
You mentioned that it's been in the works for about 90 years. Let's talk about some of those challenges and possibilities for the Glen. I've heard of some really strange development ideas that have been introduced in the past, and I think it's a lot of people are happy that those directions were not taken.
Sure. Again, 90 years ago, there were plans afoot to build an amusement park in the preserve, and Arthur Morgan, even before he became Antioch's great president in the 19-teens and 20s, condemned the land around the Yellow Spring to protect it from being developed into amusement park. His idea was he could take the water from the Yellow Spring and use it as a water source for the college and for the town. Ended up being a terrible idea. The sediment from the spring clogged all the pipes and on campus. But it was a novel approach. A handful of years later, the state made plans to build a road right through the preserve. Had they done that, not only would it have destroyed the preserve, it would have really destroyed the fabric of the town of Yellow Springs. It would have meant that traffic bypassed the town instead of becoming engaged in the street life of the community. And then just a year later, the village of Yellow Springs proposed to use Glen Helen as the repository of its municipal wastewater, i.e. sewage. All of those efforts were defeated over the years, along with a number of ones that would have been damaging to the Glen, but not quite as destructive as these others.
Let's talk a little bit about the funding behind this easement effort.
Sure. There were multiple players in this, and all of this was brought together by a partnership between Antioch College, the Trust for Public Land, and the Tecumseh Land Trust, and working with that those outside organizations, we were able to secure funding from the Clean Ohio Conservation Fund, from the Ohio Environmental Protection Agency, from the Upper River Fund of the Dayton Foundation. The village of Yellow Springs was also a contributor to this phase of the easement project, as was the Farm and Ranchland Protection Program of the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Will visitors to the Glen notice any difference, or is this the point of this land conservation easement that they will never see any difference in the Glen?
You know, that's a lot of it. I like to think that they will notice at least one big difference. Because we were able to bring in a substantial amount of funding for this project, and because Antioch College committed to taking that and ensuring that that would be able to benefit the Glenn's programs over time. What we're now going to be able to do is we've been able to hire a full-time ranger for the first time in the history of the Glen. We've been able to increase our land management staff so that we can do a better job with trail management and invasive species management. So I think what visitors are going to notice is that we're doing more than we ever have to take care of the preserve.
Great. Nick Budas, Executive Director of the Glen Helen Ecology Institute. Thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
One of the sure signs of summer is the sound of lawnmowers cutting their way through neighborhoods across the country. That sound too early on a Saturday or Sunday morning can cause the gentlest of souls to gnash their teeth and perhaps curse their neighbors. But what if your lawnmower sounded like this? These mowers walk on four legs, and they're covered in coats of thick woolly fur. Right now, they're moving in a line formation, chomping and chewing the high grass surrounding several acres of large solar array panels at the Antioch College Farm. Farm manager Kat Kristen has been on the job for about 4 years. To find out more about the farm and the part these solar sheep are playing in Antioch's sustainability efforts, we took a trip outside.
Oh, here we go. Here's these guys. We started the farm in 2011 when the college restarted, and it was a way to kind of make the campus a little more sustainable and provide some really cool experiential education for our students. So it just kind of was a really good fit for as the college started back up, you know, with the sustainability focus, you know, farming is an obvious connection to that. So
how has the response been from the students involved here?
Oh, it's been great. Students really love the farm. We have probably about 13 part-time staff right now that are all students, and we have more than one work on the farm than we have positions for. So, we've had a really great student response in terms of employing students. And students also come out as part of their different coursework, different, experiments and stuff like that out here. And that's been really good for them, too.
Tell me a little bit about the scope of what actually takes place on the farm.
So on the farm, we have an annual growing area. We have a perennial food forest, and we have some animals that we rotationally graze. And right now we're in the solar array where we're piloting grazing some sheep that will eventually be lamb for the dining hall.
So the sheep right now are also working on the farm, and tell us exactly what they're doing.
They are. They are our latest staff members of the farm. There are eight ewes, and they are mowing like crazy. So they're out here fertilizing the ground and mowing the grass down around the solar panels.
Which is needed?
Yeah. Alternatively, we'd have to either do it with, we wouldn't do it with chemicals, but other places maybe would do it with chemicals to keep the weeds down, or mechanically, which is a lot of fossil fuel use and a lot of labor. So, you know, sheep can get in all these little small spaces and eat all that grass instead of having to use the manpower out here. So we get both the mowing, the fertilizing, and then we get lamb in the dining hall. So it works out pretty well for everybody.
All right. And so how long has this program been going on? Is this the second batch of sheep that have come through?
This is our third batch of sheep. It's our first batch under the array. So this is our pilot year of figuring out, you know, how many sheep are the right number under the array? Do they bother the array? You know, how are they in this space? So this is our first year with them under the array.
I guess it's successful. You'll know whether they keep up with the work that needs to be done or not.
Yeah, we'll be able to know by, if they don't bother or break anything, that would be successful, you know, if they don't chew on the wrong things. And so far, you know, they've been really great about that. And then we'll also know, you know, by how they mow. You know, are they mowing all the places we need them to mow? Do we need to get more sheep? Do we need less sheep? You know, those kinds of questions we can answer with this pilot.
How many acres are utilized for the farm?
Yeah, so we utilize about 3 acres, and then right now we're using about 2 acres of the solar array. So that's about, you know, maybe 2 acres in perennial food forest, which is a lot of orchard plants, fruits and nuts, those kinds of things that aren't ready yet. Those will take a while to be ready for us. We have a hoop house, and then we have maybe an acre we graze chickens on, and then, of course, an annual garden growing area and a composting area. We compost a bunch of vegetable scraps from all over campus here on the farm.
Offer me a personal comment about how important you think all this work is for the college.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important work. I've been a professional farmer for 10 years myself, and I just came on to Antioch, you know, 4 years ago. So I just think some of the biggest issues of our time are related to food, whether you're talking about health and wellness, whether you're talking about environment, whether you're talking about food justice, you know, who has access to food. You know, a lot of these issues, you know, are really important issues that our students are going to have to go out into the world and be a part of and help solve. So providing a learning space for them to really get their hands dirty, literally, you know, to later address these issues, I think that's really important.
Great. Kat, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Kat Kristin with the Antioch College Farm. We've covered the past and present conservation efforts of the college in our last two stories. Up next on WISO Weekend, a look at how Antioch is facing the future of sustainable agriculture by establishing a seed school. Beth Bridgman is the instructor of cooperative education at Antioch College. She recently took a small group of students to the Seed Savers Exchange Conference in Decorah, Iowa. Seed Savers Exchange is the largest non-governmental seed bank in the United States. We spoke to Bridgman to find out more about how the exchange works and about Antioch College's plans for seed saving and education.
This year is the 40th anniversary of Seed Savers Exchange. It was started by a couple in Iowa. And we went to the 35th conference this year that they have had. Every year they have people who are interested in seed saving come from all of the United States to share their experiences. They have wonderful guest speakers. And last year I took a group of four students to the Seed Savers Conference, and they came back so enthused that some of our Antioch students then taught seed saving on the Antioch farm.
And the exchange is all about preserving heirloom varieties of seeds, correct?
Since 1900, we have lost 97%. Of seed varieties, and it's a huge problem, particularly as the climate changes. If, you know, if there's only four or five kinds of corn left, and they all get the same kind of virus, we're toast. And so it's very important to bring back the seed diversity, and that's something I'm interested in, our students are interested in. The other piece of that is that, you know, there are six big agrochemical corporations, major agrochemical corporations, and they own 85% of the world's seed companies now. They also patent that seed. And what's happening now is they're patenting the traits of those seeds. It's kind of going on under our, you know, without anybody acknowledging what's going on. So it's very important that we have access to seed sovereignty for ourselves, and that we're able to, you know, I don't think anybody should own seed, but, you know, it should be available to all of us. That's what we're interested in, is creating seed that works well for Southwest Ohio.
And so with these education efforts, the Seed School, which will be starting up in September at Antioch College, let's talk about this program.
So we decided, you know, we went to the Seed Savers Exchange Conference last year. We went to the Seed Savers Exchange Conference this year. And our students decided we really want to have something here. There's not anything like this in Ohio. This will be the first seed school to be offered in Ohio. We have Bill McDorman and Bellstar coming in from the Rocky Mountain Seed Alliance. They were formerly with Native Seed Search, and they're nationally known speakers on seed sovereignty, and we're pretty excited to have them come and partner with us. So the program will run for 6 days. It's a 6-day workshop, September 29th to October 4th, and it brings together people who are farmers, educators, backyard gardeners, anybody who's interested in food security and in seed sovereignty, together to learn how to save seed. Seed saving is an interesting thing. I'm fascinated by it. It's kind of a tricky thing. So this is about the science of seed saving. It's about the art of seed saving, and it's about the community behind that. So it's very much a community building when you start saving your own seed.
And this program, as you mentioned, is not just for Antioch students. It's open to the public, and you're even encouraging alumni to attend.
We're hoping alumni will attend, people from all over the Miami Valley, across Ohio. Anyone's welcome, and we encourage people to come, of all ages, yeah.
Do you have any details on the 6 days of this program?
There are 12 different modules that are covered. We start with the genetics behind seed, but it's very it's accessible plant genetics. It's something that, you know, all of us are able to understand. And it goes through the whole process: pollination, open pollination, wind pollination, insect pollination. The last couple of modules are on seed saving, how to create a seed bank, how to create seed libraries, and how to start your own seed business if that's something that you're interested in.
I think it's really interesting, the seed libraries. You're actually tracing the history of seed, and I guess tell us a little bit more about that part of it.
So seed libraries are where people actually bring seed, and you catalog the seed, and you can actually check out seed, or you can, it's kind of like an exchange, but it's sort of the next level up. However, what you mentioned is very interesting. At Seed Savers Exchange, you know, half of the interest and importance is in saving the seed, But unless you know the story behind the seed, you've only just saved seed. And so we actually have two co-op positions at Seed Savers Exchange in Iowa. One is a seed historian position, and the other is an assistant seed geneticist position. So when you're saving heirloom seed, you have to test that seed, and that's what our students, our co-op students can help do. The seed historian piece is, you know, where did this seed come from? Who brought it over on what boat? And what was the significance behind that? And what was it like in the country it came from? And there's really interesting stories there. And that's another thing that our oral history students are interested in. One of the things I'd like to say is that we've long been interested in sustainable ag, ecological agriculture, and organic agriculture at Antioch. You know, we have the Antioch Farm. The food from the Antioch Farm goes straight to the Antioch dining halls, and that's what our students eat. In fact, last year, our dining manager and assistant dining manager took on a program called the Real Food Challenge. It's a higher ed initiative across the country where people commit to 20% real food by 2020. The way that you figure that out is through you start with a real food calculator. And when we did that calculator, we found that we were already at 56% real food on the Antioch campus, which is the second highest in the country. So we're committing to 60% real food by 2020. So there's a real interest in this. Seed saving is just the next step. You don't have food security unless we have seed security, unless we have access to our own seed. Food security is kind of a myth. And so that's what we're interested in at Antioch College, is starting to save more of our seed. We already save seed at Antioch College. But we want to learn how to save more seed and how to do it better, how to create seed that's best suited for Southwest Ohio.
For folks interested in the program, where can they find out more information?
They can contact me, Beth Bridgman, at bbridgman@antiochcollege.org, or they can simply go to rockymountainseeds.org and register online. There's information about the program there, and you can actually register online for the program.
Great. And the program actually runs Tuesday, September 29th through Sunday, October 4th.
That's right.
Beth Bridgman is the instructor of cooperative education at Antioch College. Beth, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
WYSO is licensed to Antioch College. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning on WYSO Weekend. College Promise provides a free college education for academically gifted children from poverty-impacted families here in the Miami Valley. Community Voices producer Ron Soliday has their story.
College Promise started 4 years ago and now has over 250 children selected from area middle schools on the path to a free college education. Students begin at Sinclair Community College and can transfer to schools including Miami University, Denison, Wright State, and University of Dayton. Gary Smiga, Executive Director of College Promise, describes the program.
Our mission with College Promise is to identify, select, and support 500 poverty-impacted students who live in Montgomery County, go to school in Montgomery County, and provide for them the support that they need to receive a college degree at little to no cost to them or their families.
I asked Shireen Springer, the parent of a College Promise student, how their family found out about the program.
We found out about College Promise via an email from our school principal at the time. He thought our son, Calvin, would be a good candidate for this program.
A free college education comes with high expectations, as Shireen explains.
Maintain good grades. Stay alcohol, tobacco, drug, and crime free. Participate in school activities. Come to any at-large programs. Practice good citizenship. Maintain a financial need and attain a high school diploma.
Caleb Euchert is a first-year student in College Promise. I ask him, how do these great expectations affect him?
It just encourages me to get done with everything as fast as I can and not slack off.
What do you want to study when you get to college?
I want to study, like, physics when I get to college.
So, how do you keep hundreds of teenage kids on track for college? Gary Smiga.
You cannot just hold the carrot of a scholarship out to a 14-year-old and expect them to walk the next 4 years alone. With a mentor alongside of them, there's a much greater probability that they'll actually be at where you want them to be, or maybe even exceed where you or they thought they could even be. We have such wonderful stories coming back from our mentors about how it is such a win-win relationship, that not only is the student growing as a result of the scholarship and the time and energy the mentor's putting in, but that as adults, the mentors are growing as well.
College Promise is modeled after a program in Florida called Taking Stock in Children. I spoke to John Taylor, who discovered it, and he agrees mentoring is important.
The mentoring program they found out in Florida was the key to success. after you've done this for 2 or 3 years that you're as close to this mentee as you are to your children.
I went to Kettering Fairmont High School and talked with Susan Harris, a College Promise mentor.
I'm so amazed that at the age of 14, 15, that they've done such long-range thinking and such serious thinking about what they want to do. And granted, it may change, but the fact that they're even, you know, thinking in those terms is terrific. Certainly, at the end of 4 years, we're going to be good friends.
Nicole Will, a career tech counselor at Fairmont High School, gave me some perspective on graduation rates for poverty-impacted children.
We are seeing some pretty scary statistics for students who are considered within that poverty level. I know for students going to school for an associate's degree and graduating in 4 years, we're only seeing 13% of that poverty population in Ohio actually completing school and earning that degree. And for a bachelor's degree, it goes up to 47%, but still, those are low numbers.
The numbers for taking stock are encouraging. John Taylor explains.
92% of the kids who enter the program graduate from high school, and then 81% graduate from college.
The collective College Promise GPA is 3.44%, and of the 250 students, only three have dropped out. The cost of College Promise is $25 million for 500 scholarships, money coming from federal Pell Grants, universities, and over $6 million raised from private donors. Gary Smiga has the last word.
There are some wonderful children who are coming from struggling families that very much deserve this opportunity and very much want to be successful and be perhaps the first in their families to graduate from college.
For WYSO Community Voices, I'm Ron Soliday.
Support for Community Voices is provided by the Virginia W. Kettering Foundation. For more Community Voices stories and information on our training program, visit us at WYSO.org. This summer, Project Jericho, a nonprofit housed at Clark State in Springfield, hosted a free arts camp for local youth. They hired professional artists from around the country to teach. Young people wrote poetry, which they performed in a public concert emceed by Amina Brown, a nationally known slam poet. For Culture Couch, WYSO's latest series, Community Voices producer Dan Gummel has the story of one young man's experience at the camp.
So I walk into a room at the Kuss Auditorium in Springfield. It's full of teenagers working together, listening to music, and then I see this kid, you know, the one who always hates camp. He's sitting by himself, shoulders slumped and head down over by the speakers. And I asked, did you want to come to camp?
No, I didn't even want to.
What's your favorite kind of music?
I like all kinds of music except for this song.
Except for this song?
I listen to all kinds of music. I just don't like this song.
Well, apparently Jacob is having a hard time finding things at camp that he likes, including the music. He tried mosaic creating, but that didn't really work. Bookmaking was a little bit better, but still not great. But then things started to change for Jacob halfway through the camp when Amina Brown, the professional slam poet from Atlanta, showed up to lead the kids through a workshop on performance skills. And when she started talking about the poetry of a legendary artist, that made all the kids listen.
Family Tree is by a poet and rapper Tupac Shakur. I hope that name is familiar to you. Tupac actually had a book of poetry. So the poetry we are using today was written by Tupac as a teenager, which I think is pretty cool.
Because we all spring from different trees does not mean we are not created equally.
So we opened up the floor after each group presented to say, tell me something you dug about it. Tell me something you like about it. And it's just interesting to hear how insightful, you know, some of those comments were and that it was fun. It kind of gets you out of your own box. You had some really shy kids who just looked at me like, please don't make me do this.
After the workshop, Jacob seemed almost happy. I asked him what the difference was, and he said poetry. But despite this, Jacob was freaked out because he knew he had to perform his poem in public at the concert on Friday.
All right, so tell me how you feel, Jacob.
I'm nervous and scared. I'm going to be doing it in front of almost everybody.
Dude, that's cool, though.
Oh, it ain't.
You don't think so? I think it's exciting.
Look, I'm not no famous person like she is. I just can't go in front of a crowd and just do it with confidence and everything.
Jacob said he went home and practiced his poem in front of the mirror, just like Amina had told him. He practiced his confidence, his pronunciation, and his smile. and Friday afternoon when it came time for the big performance, he was ready.
Yeah. Give it up for Jacob.
This is the poem that I read. Home, where I sleep, where I eat. But the comforts that come with home is nowhere to be found. Why, I shout. How can you be home but far from it at the same time? Time multiplies when I'm far, but is short when I'm close. The distance between is answer and key. But why, I ask. Why?
Tell me about your poem.
My, me being in foster care inspired it. It's about me being far away from home. Me being home but far from it. Like, I'm meeting my foster care. That's my home right now. But yet, it's not my home. I'm far from home. My home is with my mom. That's what I mean by it.
I left at the end of the week thinking that poetry wins again. And in the best way, too, if I'm honest. Because you really have to root for kids like Jacob. They've got a lot to think about. And when a simple trip to summer camp becomes a discovery of who you can be and awakens a new love of poetry, well, maybe that's the best part. Or maybe not.
What's your favorite part?
My favorite part?
Yeah.
Lunch.
For WYSO Community Voices, I'm Daniel Gummel.
To see photos from Project Jericho's Summer Arts Camp, visit WYSO.org. Culture Couch is made possible by a generous grant from the Ohio Arts Council. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WYSO Weekend on WYSO. Thanks for joining us. Several universities and other institutions around the country have made headlines in the past year or two by deciding to eliminate all investments in fossil fuels. Is this action a serious step toward mitigating the effects of climate change or just a public relations ploy? University of Dayton professor Bob Brekka has more during this week's Climate Commentary.
My university, the University of Dayton, was one of the earliest and largest to make the move to divest from fossil fuels. Since we did that, I've thought about the symbolism versus the substance quite a bit. Universities in particular usually live from their tuition income. On the other hand, fundraising and cultivating donors is also an important way to ensure stability and to allow construction of new facilities, as well as funding research and other activities. Those efforts attract prospective students, who pay tuition to run the university, and then become donating alumni, thus completing the circle. As a result of this activity, institutions build up endowments which then must be invested. This is much like what many of us do with our retirement savings, with the hopes the investment returns are high. The dynamics of investing raises some interesting questions, however. Is it really true that we are only interested in maximizing our returns? If so, we might search out some questionable or even illegal ways to invest. Some people do just that. Many of us, however, might feel uncomfortable investing in something if we felt that we would be supporting causes to which we are morally opposed. But a lot of the time, we really don't know how our money is being invested when we work through a retirement plan. Universities should be able to operate a bit differently. They actually have professionals whose job it is to seek out suitable ways to make money. Even more importantly, universities are different from corporations in that they have a core mission that goes beyond simply making money for stockholders. That's why we have mission and vision statements that express high ideals for how we want to impact students and society. Because of these higher goals and duties, and since a university is presumably going to be around for a long time, there are good reasons to think that we can weigh many different factors when investing money. But what about the nuts and bolts of eliminating fossil fuel investments, or the effectiveness of this strategy to help mitigate climate change? The real answer to both questions is that this isn't really a big deal. Fossil fuel-based companies typically make up something like 5 to 10% of the investments, so divestment shouldn't matter much, even if the financial advisor happened to take all of that money and put it into companies that performed particularly poorly. But why would she do that when it would be possible to at least invest in stocks gaining as much as the average of the rest of the portfolio? A recent op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal claimed that divestment made bad economic sense and would result in significant losses for those choosing to divest. A bit of close reading of the report, upon which the op-ed was based, showed that it was filled with poor and unrealistic assumptions designed to scare readers looking at only the headline. Another take on this issue is that a world interested in mitigating the worst of climate change is also a world that will be phasing out the burning of fossil fuels over the next few decades. Therefore, those companies basing their own value on the amount of carbon on the books could very well be facing problems due to stranded assets, stuff they have that nobody wants. From that point of view, gradual divestment from fossil fuels might just simply be a prudent financial strategy. This can be seen as the reason behind the announcements by Stanford and the University of Washington to divest from coal stocks. The second part of the question is more interesting. Is divestment effective? We shouldn't discount the power of symbolism. Since fossil fuels do not make up a big part of typical investment portfolios, by definition, divestment shouldn't matter too much. But as more institutions decide that fossil fuels as a class have enough negative impacts, the industry itself will be stigmatized. In the end, what's needed is a change in our energy supplies, not just a change in our investment portfolios. Until that happens, a straightforward, easy-to-understand rallying cry can be a way to start an important conversation about our energy system. That might be the most important contribution of the divestment movement. For WYSO, this is Bob Brekka.
Bob Brekka is a professor of physics and renewable and clean energy. He's the coordinator of the Sustainability, Energy, and Environment Program at the University of Dayton. For more stories and commentaries, visit our website, wyso.org. That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, public radio for the Miami Valley. I'm Jerry Kenney. We'll be back next week. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.